Our first case is DiBella v. The People, and we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
May it please the court, my honorable opponent, I'm Blaine Myrie, counsel for petitioner John Arthur DiBella. Now, the reason this case is before this court is there is an issue that has arisen in several cases, in a line of cases out of the Court of Appeals, as well as the Frasco case in this court, having to do with the use of testimonial exhibits, that is, videotapes, audio tapes, and transcripts during jury deliberations. And there is, a lot of law in other jurisdictions that involves similar type issues, and the courts have struggled with just exactly what should trial courts be doing, what exactly should juries be having, and under what circumstances may these be provided to the jury during jury deliberations. And in the Frasco case of a few years ago, this court rejected a line of cases out of the Court of Appeals, the McKinney line of cases, that had said because of an amendment to the rules of civil procedure, all admitted exhibits, including testimonial exhibits, may go back with the jury. This court in Frasco said, no, that is something that has to be within the trial court's discretion, and the trial court has an obligation to assure that jurors are not permitted to use exhibits in a manner that is unfairly prejudicial to a party. And that's what we have here. In Mr. DiBella's case, the jury was allowed to have unfettered, unrestricted access to the videotaped statement of the victim during deliberations. And I'd like to address that issue first, why this was an abuse of discretion by the trial.
Can you just set up the facts a little bit? Did the victim testify at trial, and how did the tape or video, whatever it was, come in?
Yes, Your Honor. The victim did testify at trial. First, the victim testified and was subject to cross-examination. Then later on in the case, one of the detectives who had been involved in the making of the forensic interview of the victim testified, and it was at that time that the videotape was admitted into evidence as a prior inconsistent statement under Colorado statute.
And it was played in its entirety?
Was played in its entirety before the jury, and at that time there was no instruction given by the trial court not to place undue emphasis on the videotape.
And about how long is the video?
The videotape, well, there are actually two videotapes. The one we're most concerned about was about an hour long.
Okay.
The first videotape, which was, I would say, less important to the case, was about 25 minutes. So there were actually two forensic interviews, both admitted over defense counsel objection, and both were played before the jury. Now, the trial court at the time decided this case before this case came down with the Frasco opinion. And because of that, the trial court relied on the McKinney line of cases when it came time for jury deliberations. The court allowed the videotape of the second interview, the key interview, to go back unrestricted to the jury for deliberations without objection. The court did not wait for the jury to request to see the videotape. He gave no restrictions to the jury on how it could use the tape, how long it could have the tape, under what circumstances it could review it, whether it could replay portions, whether it could skip portions, and whether it could deliberate while the tape was playing.
Counsel, can I stop you there?
Yes.
I mean, you've gone through this litany of the things that the district court did not do. Do you think that the district court has to do each one of those, or what do you think is the bare minimum?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I think there is a bare minimum that has to be done that wasn't done here.
Okay.
And then
which
I think
is,
there's
which is what? Yeah.
Yeah. The
identify
bare minimum that,
that
had to be done was, number one, he had to wait for a request from the jury. Because by not waiting for a request to the jury, the court put the videotape before the jury and skewed the balance of the evidence in the case. The jury didn't have the trial testimony of the victim before it, but it had the much stronger, much more prosecution favorable evidence before it and the means to play it without asking to review that.
Go ahead. Please.
Do you think that would be the case with all kinds of evidence, like picture evidence or anything else?
No.
What's the difference, and why would the judge have to wait for a request for this kind of evidence where he doesn't have to wait for sending back pictures or bloody shirts or anything else?
It's the testimonial nature of it. As courts in other jurisdictions have noted, testimonial exhibits such as audio tapes of witness interviews or videotapes, in this case of a forensic interview, or transcripts themselves of either in-court or out-of-court statements, are testimonial in nature. The questioning that went on in the videotape is a forensic interview. It is set up with the notion that this is going to be used not only for investigative purposes, but to create a record in the event that it's needed to play at trial.
What if it were like a security tape from a bank or an ATM? Is that the kind of thing you're worried about, or is it just testimony where somebody asks somebody else questions?
It's just the testimonial nature of it. Surveillance tapes and tapes like that are substantive evidence of the crime, and they're a snapshot of what actually happened. This is more in the nature of, you could call it witness interrogation or witness interviews, where you're actually establishing a testimonial type record of the victim's answers to specific questions. And that is the problem. And that's what the other courts have said. It's putting
a forensic. Insofar as your bare minimum is concerned, I guess the other question would be, what if it is testimonial, but it's of relatively minor insignificance in the case? Even in that situation, the court would have to wait for a request?
I think the court should wait for a request, although if it's minor in nature, I don't think the jury is probably going to be that interested in it, but even if the jury is interested.
Well, isn't what's significant then there is that the court makes some decision about what degree of supervision is necessary, and that decision could entail, for example, that this is a pretty minor testimony and really isn't necessary to exercise a great deal of supervision here?
It's certainly within the court's jurisdiction. Let's say if it's a very minor witness testifying on some minor point. Take for example, a witness who is unavailable for trial and has to testify on some minor point. That tape is maybe not central to the case, and if it's not central to the case, then there's less of a chance of the undue emphasis
being
placed on it.
So it would be fair to say that the trial judge could conceivably, in the right circumstances, in its exercise of discretion, decide not to exert any supervisory control at all and send it right in?
Well, I think the court should consider any testimonial exhibit and whether there's a danger of undue emphasis before making that decision. But I think with minor things, that would be a possibility. But that's not the case here. I mean,
before you get into the nature of the testimony of the tape and how it differs, is it the case here in terms of the judge making a decision that it was unnecessary to exercise any supervisory?
No, the judge made no such finding. He solely relied on the McKinney case and the McKinney line of cases for the proposition that since it was an admitted exhibit, it would go back to the jury. There was no supervision that he engaged in. He didn't engage in any kind of the analysis of whether this would be unfairly prejudicial or whether this the type of evidence that could go back to the jury and would not create the risk of unfair prejudice or undue emphasis.
So there was a failure to exercise any discretion, understandable, because he was relying, in fact, controlled by a line of authority that is contrary to Fresco.
That's correct, Your Honor. The McKinney line of cases basically dictated what the trial court was to do here.
Well, then isn't the first question whether that failure to exercise discretion is an abuse of discretion?
And it is. It is. The failure to exercise discretion, as this court said in People v. Darlington, is itself an abuse of discretion. The court has to engage in the kind of analysis necessary to consider whether giving the jury videotape of this nature can result in the type of undue emphasis that this court in Frasco and earlier in Settle had said the court has to guard against to ensure a fair trial.
Aren't we second-guessing the trial court here, though? Frasco wasn't decided until after this trial, so the guidelines, the cautionary guidelines we introduced are a gloss on top of the rule that allowed the admission of all the exhibits, aren't they?
Well, The McKinney line of cases allowed that in, but the McKinney line of cases was not the authority. The authority was still Settle at that point, which did say that the trial court had to take steps to assure that there was not undue emphasis or undue weight placed on it. So I don't think the trial court was necessarily bound to apply McKinney. It's understandable that the trial court did. But in terms of second guessing, under the Lopez case and other cases from this court applies the law that's in effect at the time of the direct appeal. So as long as Mr. DiBella's direct appeal was pending when Frasco was decided, Frasco applies, even though it applies in sort of a retroactive fashion to what the trial court did.
Well, when you were saying that the trial judge relied on McKinney, is there evidence to that effect in the record?
Yes, in the two pages of transcript that were attached to the opening brief, the judge, in fact, cites McKinney, I think, at two different points, which I believe is page 145 and 146 of volume 9 of the record.
Okay.
And so getting back to what the trial court didn't do here, because of McKinney, he made no inquiry into whether there would be unfair prejudice or undue emphasis placed on this videotape. He didn't limit the jury's use of it. He didn't give any cautionary instructions either at the time it was played in court during trial or at the time he sent it back to the jury for deliberations. He gave no consideration at all to whether there was undue emphasis, and that is an abuse of discretion.
Can I stop you there? So what should the judge have done? I mean, just is the instruction enough? Or?
Well, here's what I say the judge should have done. Number one, he should not have sent the videotape back to the jury room at all. That creates the risk of undue emphasis, and it also creates a problem with the record.
Are you asking us to come up with just a flat rule? No testimonial videotape ever goes back with the jury.
Right, and that I am, and that's along the lines of what the Florida Supreme Court did in the Young case cited in our briefs and the Wyoming Supreme Court did in the Chambers case cited in our briefs. Now, I know Frasco did not hold that, but I think as a cautionary measure, not allowing the videotape back in the jury room ensures a couple things. It ensures, number one, that the jury will not have this kind of unrestricted access to it. Number two, it ensures that we will have an idea of what the jury sees, how the jury viewed or replayed the videotape, if it's done in open court with the parties present. Doing that ensures that the jury sees the videotape again, and yet there's a record of it and a record of how it happens. There's a record of what counsel and the court agree to do, and it also ensures that the evidence stays on a relatively equal footing with the other trial evidence. Because after the tape is played and the jury then retires again to the jury deliberation room, the jury is left to its collective memory of the videotape, just like it's left to its collective memory of the trial testimony. And that avoids the danger of undue emphasis, or at least greatly eliminates it, by making sure that the videotape stays on relatively the same footing as the trial testimony.
Excuse me, this is, I suppose, just kind of an obvious question, but I'm not certain of it. Do we know that the jury had some way to play the videotape first, and second, that they did in fact play the videotape?
First, we know that the jury did have the means to play it because that was part of what the trial court did. It sent the videotape and the TV means to play it back there. That's in the record.
Okay.
Yeah, the same pages that are attached to the opening brief. In terms of whether the jury, in fact, replayed it, because of the way the trial court did this, we have no idea. And that's the other problem that this procedure created. The judge didn't wait for a request from the jury, so we don't know whether the jury requested to see it. Now, I would note that the jury deliberated for 7 hours, or about 7 hours, according to the trial record. This was not a case with a lot of witnesses. And certainly the key witness, and the key witness in the case, was the victim. And the key piece of evidence, other than the victim's testimony in court, was this videotape. So I don't think it's beyond the pale to think that the jury probably reviewed it, but there's nothing in the record to indicate that, and that's because the trial court did not wait for a request.
Well, can I ask you why the trial court didn't allow the jury to have that first video? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, now, so what was the basis for the differential treatment?
There was a portion of the first videotape that was ruled inadmissible. The victim got upset and left, and then there were some ancillary discussions going on and stuff that was not relevant or more prejudicial, and the tape needed to be redacted, and the prosecution didn't have a redacted tape made at the time of jury deliberations. The prosecutor brought that to the court's attention, and what the court said is, okay, what we're going to do is not give them that first tape. We're going to wait for the jury to make a request, and if we do it, we're going to view it in open court so it can be stopped at the appropriate time. So the trial court recognized with the first tape that he shouldn't give it to them to avoid the kind of unfair prejudice, but made no conclusion on that with regard to the second tape.
Well, can't you infer from that, though, that the trial court did make some sort of conclusion? I mean, because he thought, didn't he think carefully about that first tape? And I guess you're just suggesting that he didn't think at all about the second tape?
Well, I think he looked at McKinney, and since the second tape was admissible in its entirety, it could go straight back there. With the first tape, he had ruled portions of it inadmissible after a certain point.
And then I'm sure we'll hear this argument, so I just want to get your thoughts on it. Can an inference be drawn that since the jury did not ask to see that first tape, that they did not view the second tape? Or are they just more particularly interested in the tape?
Well, I think if you view the two tapes, it's apparent why the jury wouldn't request the first tape. The first tape has virtually no evidence to support any of the charges in this case. And as I think I noted in the opening or the reply brief, there was really no reason for the jury to request the first tape. They certainly could have if they wanted to. But the second tape is the tape that has all the prosecution evidence. It's much stronger evidence than was testified to at trial, and it wasn't essentially the case rises or falls based on the trial testimony and the second videotape.
Well, remind us how the second videotape was created and under what circumstances, and generally describe the contents of it, if you would.
It's what's called a forensic interview videotape without the knowledge of the witness, the victim. There was a police officer present, a detective, along with a social services worker of some sort who is trained in doing this kind of interviews, sort of a child protective component. The interview proceeds. It's videotaped and time coded, and there are questions asked. There are drawings made, and they essentially are trying to elicit, without being too leading, what the victim has to say and the story the victim has to tell. Now, the danger with these videotapes and why they can present so much undue emphasis is they're ex parte. They're conducted by law enforcement personnel, and they are videotapes which show the emotion that the victim witness is going through. There is no evidence, there's no impeaching evidence, there's no cross-examination. And what you have at with the trial testimony is a witness who has memory issues, who is impeached with instances of conduct where he has been fairly dishonest, engaged in false 911 reports, lied about seeing the defendant on the 16th Street Mall, and only sort of confessed that he was lying when confronted by the police about it.
Could you remind me how old the child was?
I believe at the time of the interview, he was 13. And at the time of the incidents, he was, I think, either between 11 and 13.
Well, on the other hand, isn't a tape like that a lot more reliable than something that comes out of trial much later on? It's more contemporaneous with the facts, and they actually show a jury the kind of manifestation of what might be considered a truthful statement.
Well, it's up to the jury to determine, I think, the credibility, reliability of that. It is certainly a preserved snapshot in time of what the witness said on that day. But it is not subject to confrontation. It's not subject to cross-examination. And cross-examination is key in a case like this, where it hinges on the witness's credibility. And yes, it's an important piece of evidence, and that's precisely why it should not have been given to the jury in the jury room without any checks or balances on its use.
Assuming for a moment that we were to find abuse of discretion and we're working on whether it's reversible or not, it seems to me clear that if we knew that the tape had not been watched at all or had been watched many, many times, that that would be a consideration in the reversible error process or decision-making process. So my question is, what should we do with the fact that we don't know whether they looked at it at all or many times?
Well, I think that's precisely the reason to adopt a procedure that ensures that we know what the jury, if the jury views it or not. That takes away that element of it. But because we're faced with a situation where we don't know, I think Judge Daley pointed out in his dissent the right approach to this. The courts have looked at the evidence and decided whether there's a likelihood it was given undue emphasis. In fact, that's the same language the Settle case, this court used in the Settle case in 1972, is whether there was a likelihood of it being given undue weight.
Isn't there a step in between that? Why couldn't the court just ask the jurors in the case whether or not they viewed that videotape?
Well, unfortunately, under Rule 606B, that can't get into the record. If the trial court doesn't know, the attorneys can't inquire. Under Rule 606B, the jurors cannot have been interviewed and told about what they did with the videotape. It's an admitted exhibit. It wasn't anything extraneous. So none of the exceptions under Rule 606B of the Rules of Evidence would have allowed an inquiry into what the jury did.
So just go over what that rule says.
Well, the rule basically says that a juror cannot testify about what goes on in the deliberation room except where there are issues of improper items being brought into the jury room, such as extraneous Bibles, evidence, things that weren't admitted at trial, or in certain other circumstances where there was the possibility of improper influence on the jurors or some problems. It doesn't address a situation like this where the jury, having the videotape, was not doing anything that except possibly reviewing an admitted exhibit. The problem is that that admitted exhibit, unlike other exhibits, other static exhibits or substantive exhibits, had a testimonial quality to it. And courts in many other jurisdictions, as we've noted in our opening brief, have found this to be problematical. And they have, and many of them have analyzed it even when the jury did not necessarily request the videotape. The Martin case out of the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, for example, there was no evidence in that case that the jury had viewed the tape. So the question becomes, what should this court do? This court should look at the videotape in context with the trial testimony and particularly the cross-examination and impeachment of the witness. And
excuse me, mm-hmm. I didn't mean to interrupt, but before you get on to what your remedy, proposed remedy is, I want to make sure I understand exactly what your position is. So are you saying that under no circumstances, I think you're saying, let me put it this way, that under no circumstances should the judge let the tape go back to the jury for their unfeathered, unsupervised viewing of the tape. But you're not going so far as to say that should the jury then, not having the tape, ask to see the tape again, that they should not be allowed to do that?
I think the jury absolutely should be able to request it.
Okay, now, here's what's sort of interesting about that logic is that the jury obviously can't hear the child testify again, as he did in open court, right?
Right.
Because that happened once, it wasn't taped, it's done and over with.
Right.
So if they asked, they'd be able to see the tape made of the child in his earlier social services interview again, a second, maybe even a third or a fourth time, if they asked, right?
Well, I think the trial court needs to put at least some limitation on it. I, as defense counsel, I would object to being it replayed at all.
Well, I understand, but most judges, and you're not suggesting that it would be outside their discretion to allow a second and maybe even a third hearing of that tape.
Certainly, replaying the entire thing from start to finish one time, I think in open court, so that there's no deliberation going on during that, I don't think that would be an abuse of discretion.
The tape was played during the trial.
It was played during the trial, that's correct.
So why doesn't it follow, why doesn't your position then really follow that if it's going to be treated exactly, if the tape is going to be treated exactly the same as live testimony, let's just call it that, the jury should be allowed to hear the live testimony once and see the tape once, but no more?
Well, I think that's a bright line rule and certainly would be easy to enforce, but I think I think that would be somewhat inconsistent with the focus in allowing the jurors more access to notes, to exhibits than they had in the past.
Well, that's exactly where the rubber hits the road,
right,
isn't it? Is how to give them more access, because this has become something that we now call evidence or admitted evidence as opposed to live testimony.
Right.
And how are you going to help us draw those lines?
Well, I think the line you draw is with a testimonial exhibit, and I think it's relatively easy to define those. Forensic interviews, police interrogations, other types of interviews, not sort of the surveillance stage, but that type of information should not be given to the jury. It should be viewed only in open court to ensure that there is a record of whether the jury views that or not.
Mr. Murray, could I interrupt you down here 1 second? You've said that several times with regard to this general rule. You've been arguing primarily that the Court of Appeals held that the trial court erred as a result of what we said in Frasco. I think that seems clear. Do you now want us to hold, though, that the holding in Frasco was wrong as a result of the general rule you're now asking us to adopt?
No, I think Frasco didn't have to address the issue here because there was a request from the jury, but I believe the better practice would be...
I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood your general rule. I thought you wanted us to come up with a rule that the videotape should not be sent back to the jury, even upon request.
I think it should, but I think that can be harmonized with Frasco by recognizing that in that case, there was no objection by the judge. Excuse me, by defense counsel, that the jury had made the request. Maybe it is taking a step back from Frasco, but I think it's a step that ensures that the appellate record is going to reflect what happens, and it's going to help avoid the dangers of undue emphasis we're faced with here.
But it would seem that Frasco suggests that the trial court should give an instruction beforehand, don't give any extraordinary or greater emphasis to this type of testimonial exhibit than you would any other evidence in the case, right? Isn't that what Frasco stands for?
Yes, that and settle. Yes, that's true.
Okay, so, I mean, enforcement of that rule would be that in this case, the court didn't give such a cautionary instruction.
That's correct.
Right, so why should we go beyond that holding?
Because in future cases, it will help ensure that this issue doesn't keep coming up. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
You may.
Good morning. May it please the court, defense counsel. My name is Kathy Gillespie, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado here this morning in the DiBella case. This is kind of a unique situation because, as the court's already pointed out, when the trial court was trying this case with the parties, it didn't have the benefit of this court's decision in Frasco, and it was relying on a whole series of cases that had come up through the Court of Appeals, relying on a civil rule of procedure to try and help the trial court judges figure out what to do with these pieces of evidence that are considered trial or testimonial evidence. As a little bit of background in this particular case, this young man was sexually abused from the time he was 8 until the time he was 13 by a family friend. The sexual abuse came to light when this child was hospitalized at Children's Hospital for suicide attempts. He disclosed at that point what had taken place as part of his reason for the hospitalization, and that therapist, as is required by law, reported that to the authorities. As is often the case in these child sex assault situations, the children are given an opportunity to tell their story and their allegations to a non-threatening, what to them is an independent person, which is the forensic interviewer. Oftentimes, a police officer will be present, but he'll be present in plain clothes. And the child is given an opportunity to make their statement in a non-threatening situation. A lot of times it takes place in a house. The room looks like a living room. It's a lot less intimidating than being in front of the court. Then what happens is when the case is brought to trial in the district court, there is a statute in Colorado called the Child Hearsay Statute. And the parties, the defense counsel and the prosecution, litigate whether or not these statements are reliable. And there are certain indicia of reliability that the court can look at, which are unique to children making statements as opposed to adults. Adults can have the forethought to think, if I make this type of allegation, this person's going to get into trouble and this is going to be the ramification of that allegation. And Colorado has decided that that is a lot less apparent with children and that there are certain indicia of reliability that we can look at to see whether or not there are any concerns about the statement. In this particular case, the trial court did go through that child hearsay hearing with both videotapes. So the first interview with the child, the forensic interview, was about 30 minutes. The child was highly emotional. It was immediately after he had disclosed the sexual abuse for the first time. There were not a lot of details given the forensic interviewer. The child just wasn't in an emotional place to be able to give the forensic interviewer the details. So the interview was terminated. A period of time passed, about a little less than a month, and then the child was brought back in to see if he could go forward with the interview. And it's in that interview that this particular child disclosed the details of what took place to him, the circumstances surrounding the sexual assaults. When the trial court made its child hearsay ruling, it ruled that the first interview was admissible under the child hearsay statute. It then made a finding that the statements in the second interview were reliable, but it was not going to rule at that point that the statements or the videotape was admissible until it heard the child testify at trial. And at that point, the trial court then said, depending on what the child says at trial, the videotape may come in under 1610.301, which is what we call a prior inconsistent statement. Because as the court's aware, somebody is going to make a statement in March of 2005, and then the case may not come to trial for another year, year and a half. Well, no one tells the same details of a story twice. It doesn't mean that the person is lying, but there are always inconsistencies. And so what the trial court was waiting to do was to see how the testimony would play out at trial and then make a decision at that point as to whether or not it was necessary to admit that videotape. And to see what
that seems like a little bit of an unusual procedure to wait and hear the child testify before deciding whether the tape itself was admissible and reliable.
It is in a situation of a child hearsay tape. Usually with a forensic interview, the trial court will make that decision and then just admit it. Here, I think the trial court was taking an abundance of caution.
What was the judge concerned about? Whether the child was reliable or?
No, he wasn't concerned about the reliability of the child at all. What he was concerned about was whether or not the testimony of the child and the videotape was going to be cumulative. In other words, part of the purpose of these tapes is that when you try and bring a child in and put them in a witness stand, they have 12 adult strangers sitting there as part of the jury listening to them talk about a very intimate, embarrassing, horrific situation that they've been victimized. And so what the tape allows the prosecutor to do is to protect the child to a certain point and give the child the ability to tell their story without all that extraneous pressure. Now, we want that extraneous pressure when we have an adult on the stand, because we want through cross-examination to make sure that that adult understands that they need to tell the truth, that this is a courtroom setting, and that they need to be truthful in what they say. But there are some, a little bit of leeway when you're dealing with a child. And in this particular case, I think the trial court could have gone either way. I think it would have been perfectly fine for the trial court to have admitted it flat out during the motions hearing and say it was coming in. But I think in this particular case, the trial court was using its discretion and was going to wait and see. And then if it could come in, and it wasn't cumulative, which turned out not to be in this particular case, because when this child took the stand, a period of time had lapsed and he was unable to give specific testimony about the incidents of sexual assault.
How much time had lapsed? Did you say
It was a little over a year and a half before they went to trial. So he was sexually abused from roughly the age of 8 to the age of 13, and then he was 14 and a half when he went to trial.
So does it follow that the jury was within its prerogatives to look at that tape and see what additional details were brought out?
Yes, and
as a result of that?
Yes, sir. And that's common in any situation. I mean, when you have an adult witness on the stand who's filled out a written report to a police officer, a statement, oftentimes the adult will testify, and then either the prosecution or the defense, depending on who the statements favor, will then confront that witness with, well, on March of last year, didn't you tell the police officer that the shirt he was wearing was red? And in this situation, that's what the videotape is often used for. And I would, obviously, the district court or the trial court didn't have the benefit of Frasco. And my argument is that they could the district court have done a better job of setting up some parameters as to how this videotape was used, obviously. And had it had the benefit of Frasco at the time it made its decision, most likely it would have.
What about this point that since it was on a direct appeal, still when Frasco was decided that it should be applied here, how would you counter that?
I would agree with it, actually. I think the case was on direct appeal at the time Frasco was decided. I think that is, it puts the trial court in an untenable situation. I mean, the trial court didn't do anything wrong, it just didn't know. And it puts this court in a difficult position because you're being asked to go back and look at a decision that the trial court didn't specifically know that it had to make. And oftentimes, trial courts will exercise their discretion without outlining it for the court on the record. You know, I'm making this decision, here are the reasons why, here are the reasons I've considered. And the trial court's not necessarily required to do that, otherwise our trials would last for months. In this particular case, I think that this court, as the Court of Appeals did, can look at the record in this case, look at the specific facts, and decide whether or not it was an abuse of discretion and if there was any prejudice to the defense.
So inherent in that is that you maintain that the court did make a discretionary decision, as opposed to the court believing it had no discretion to do anything other than to send the tape back to the jury.
I do. I don't think that the court necessarily laid that out for us in the record, again, because I don't think that it knew the importance necessarily of the details of the decision it was making.
But isn't that sort of contrary to the authority that the court was relying on?
No, at the time, McKinney Settle indicated that the trial court needed to make sure that no exhibits were not given to the jury in a manner that would give undue influence. And I think in this particular case, it's obvious that the trial court didn't believe that giving this jury unfettered access to the videotape itself was giving it any undue emphasis. A lot has changed since Settle. We trust our juries more. We expect that, during the course of a trial, we try very hard through the court's instructions to make sure that the jury is not deliberating, that it doesn't make any decisions until all of the evidence has been presented. Everything is presented, what we hope is in a very fair and impartial manner, at the time that the evidence is being presented. But once those parties rest and the jury is instructed that they may now consider the case, they are told that it is their decision at that point to give weight to different pieces of evidence. That's how they make their decision. They're not sent back to the jury room and said, here are the 15 pieces that you can consider. You can't give any more weight to one piece of evidence than another. They're being told at that point, you've heard everything. Now it's your job to go back there and make a decision and for you to decide what the most important pieces of evidence are.
But you'd have to agree that the child obviously was emotional and was describing, as you said yourself, some pretty horrific things. And if in fact the jury was back there playing this tape over and over and over, I mean, that is of concern, isn't it?
It could be. I think that the big difference that I see between Frasco in this particular case is the if. What they are asking you to do is to reverse this case based purely on speculation. In Frasco, because the trial court held back the videotape, which I argue gives it almost more emphasis because it's telling the jury, hey, we're going to give you all this other evidence that was admitted at trial, but we're going to hold back this really interesting piece back here, and you don't get to consider it unless you ask for it. And I think to a lay person, that almost puts it up on a pedestal compared to the other evidence that's coming back.
Well, in this particular case, the trial judge didn't give the jury any instructions on the videotape.
He did not.
And isn't that a problem here?
I don't think it's a problem here. I think when the court looks at the totality of the circumstances here, and one thing that defense counsel failed to mention was the fact that throughout closing arguments at the end of the trial, defense counsel asked the jury to look at the videotape. His start of his closing argument, his entire theory of his case was, these two stories are inconsistent. This child, you can tell that this child is essentially being untruthful because of the inconsistencies between his first interview, his second interview, conversations with his mother, and then his trial testimony.
Well, you can also argue that the defense counsel was just making the best of a bad situation because the judge has already said it was going in.
You can, except for the fact that these arguments were made from opening statements all the way through the presentation of the evidence, even before the videotapes were introduced to the jury.
But this, I thought you were saying that the defense counsel asked the jurors to look at the videotape.
No, during closing argument, he argued about the inconsistencies, talked to the jury about the body language on one of the videotapes, and that they needed to compare the testimony between the two parts. And I think in my answer brief, I cited to 9 different parts of the closing argument where he was comparing the testimony, the trial testimony, and then the videotaped interviews with the child. So the inconsistencies, as is often the case in these child sex assault cases, the inconsistencies in this child's testimony benefited the defense, and that was what they were arguing.
But let me get this straight, though, to answer what the Chief Justice said. Wasn't the argument made after the defense counsel had objected to the videotape going to the jury? Then the arguments come, so the defense counsel has the situation where he or she already knows it's going to go back and tries to make the best of it. That is the sequence, right?
Correct. And for those statements that were made during closing argument, that would be correct. But in answer to Chief Justice Malarkey's question, there were also arguments made. In other words, when the videotape was introduced during the trial, in almost entirety of the cross-examination of the child was, didn't you say this on this occasion? Didn't you say that on that prior occasion? So before defense counsel even knew the videotape was going to go back into the jury room, his theory and opening statements, his theory was in this particular case that the child was inconsistent, was lying to get attention, and that they needed to pay attention to those inconsistencies. Then during cross-examination of the child and of the mother, of the forensic interviewer, they again went into the various inconsistencies and how this child's allegations allegedly changed. So yes, I would agree with you that the arguments in closing argument came after he knew that, but that was his theory throughout the case.
Well, he also knew when he did his opening, he knew those were going to come into evidence.
Correct, and they were admitted properly. That's not before.
Well, do you agree with counsel that the rule that he spoke about would bar the court from asking the jurors only this question, did you watch the videotape?
Yes, I would agree that's...
And the reason for that rule is what?
We don't want to delve into the deliberations of the jury. They're secret. That's part of the nature of our system, is that they get to go back into the jury room, they get to give the appropriate amount of weight, and if we open that door and start asking them juror A thought this was important, juror B thought this was important, juror C, we could second guess them forever. And our system allows them to make the decision. Once we have presented the evidence to them, it is up to them to go back into the jury room, decide what they think is most important as far as the evidence, and to come back and tell us if the prosecution's proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And so
okay, so let's assume they watched it at least once in the jury room. Why is it not prejudicial, given the totality of the case?
In this particular case, I think because the videotape benefited both sides. I think in this particular case, there were a lot of inconsistencies between the child's trial testimony and his statements during the videotape. And I think that they could have been watching that. And again, this is why we don't, I think it's dangerous to speculate. One, that they even watched it, because unlike in Frasco, we know that they asked to see that videotape. And they asked for the video recorder and the videotape to come back into the jury room. And that was, when we argued Frasco before this court, that was critical to the court at that time, was we know that they looked at this videotape. We know they considered it in their deliberations. In this case, you would be reversing based on pure speculation. And my argument, as one of the justices pointed out, when the first videotape did not go back into the jury room, there was never a request made for it. So you could also speculate that they never looked at this videotape, in which case we would be reversing a criminal conviction on something that never took place. And so I think this court has to look at the evidence that we do have, the record that we do have in this particular case. And again, could the district court have done more? Absolutely. But the purpose of abuse of discretion is for this court to look back on the record and decide if there is support for what the trial court did. And
Ms. Gillespie, you make a powerful argument that certain reasoning could take us to reversing a case where, in fact, unbeknownst to us, the jury never looked at the tape at all. But doesn't the powerful argument on the other side exist as well? And that is, we could be affirming a decision where the jury went back and listened to the tape 20 times and played pieces over and over again very slowly. Isn't that of concern as well?
I don't think in this particular case it is a concern, because of what I've said before, which is this videotape was beneficial to both sides. I mean, it proved the inconsistencies that supported the defense theory that this child was being untruthful, was attention-seeking, was trying to get himself out of trouble. So
would you say then that this, well, I think that you would probably agree that in a very general sense, the tape of the victim describing the assault in a case where the victim's credibility is at stake is a very powerful piece of evidence. But you would say here, it loses its power because there were inconsistencies with the in-court testimony.
Exactly. And I think it's important for the court to remember that just because a piece of evidence is powerful does not make it unfairly prejudicial. Every piece of evidence that the prosecution introduces at trial is...
Well, that's of course true, but the unfairness would result from the multiple viewings if that in fact occurred.
It could, but they could have also watched it multiple times to see whether or not, you know, defense counsel was correct and the child lied on 15 different occasions during the course of the videotape. So as we argued in Frasco, just because they're viewing it multiple times does not mean that it's beneficial to the prosecution.
Of course, if you were reviewing it for that, you would probably benefit from being able to review the live testimony in order to make that comparison. In the absence of the review of both, do you think that the review of the tape alone makes it more powerful?
I don't, because I think you have to give the jury the ability to pick out what pieces of evidence it wants to look at again.
In which case, why should we prevent the jury from viewing these tapes multiple times to begin with? I mean, maybe does that cut the other direction? Perhaps there should be no supervision.
Well, I think it could cut both ways. And
particularly in light of the fact that you said, and it's a generalization, but I think you're probably right, generally, that in these kinds of situations, of course there are inconsistencies. And so I guess what I'm saying is I infer from what you've said that you're always going to have a tape with inconsistencies from the in-court testimony. So that leads me to conclude from your argument that perhaps it would make sense to go ahead and let the jury view it as many times as they wish.
Well, and that was our argument in Frasco, but this court decided that there should be some limits placed on it. And so Now we're bound by this court's decision in Fresco, and I think this court was clear in Fresco.
Well, then, but the point is you're using, I think, then the same reasoning that was used in the argument in Fresco to arrive at the conclusion today that we should be unconcerned about the possibility of multiple viewings of the tape.
In this particular case, I don't think you should be concerned about it. I think there are factual scenarios in some of these cases that could present themselves to the point where viewing it multiple times over and over again. For instance, if it was, you know, in a homicide case, a three-year-old that's being interviewed on a videotape and is telling a story about how he watched one of his parents murdered in front of him, when it's not necessarily a give and take and questions and answers because of the age of the child, in that particular situation, if there was a lot of emotion that was present in the videotape with this particular child, in that situation, viewing it over and over again multiple times may cause some concern, and might even cause some concern to me as part of the, as for the people, because even though we like the decisions to go our way, we also have an obligation to present our cases to a jury. And the, in this particular case, and that's what Fresco left open for us, was you have to look at the facts of the particular case. And I think the court in Fresco was correct in not giving us a blanket rule of saying it can never be helpful. And the court was very clear in Fresco to say, sometimes for tactical reasons, both the defense and the prosecution, we've had these forensic interview tapes that the prosecution never introduces at trial because it's so detrimental to their case, and then the defense introduces it. So I think you have to make the decision on a case-by-case basis. And in this particular case, because of the facts, I think the court can look at it and say there was no unfair prejudice in this particular case. And I would also just quickly point out to the court that under this abuse of discretion standard, there is obviously support for what the trial court did, because we split the Court of Appeals. Two judges in the Court of Appeals agreed with what the trial court did, and one did not. And I think under an abuse of discretion standard, that pushes this court in the direction of, is there support in the record for what the trial court did? And is there support in the record to demonstrate that there is no danger of unfair prejudice? And I think in this particular case, there was. And I think this court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision.
Should I ask you to move on to Mr. Myrie's proposed test? Because he would have us say that the videotape should not ever be sent to the jury unless the jury requests it. And then at that point, the judge should weigh all these factors. What's your position?
I think that, in my opinion, that emphasizes this particular piece of evidence. I think that there is no reason, when something has gone through the tests of the motions hearings, it's been found to be reliable, it's been litigated pretrial, that everything was done properly. I think once that piece of evidence comes into evidence, that the jury should be able to use that with, in some cases that request is going to be appropriate. I just don't think that there needs to be a blanket rule across the board that should always be the situation.
Isn't your position that you just stated arguing Fresco was wrongly decided?
No, I think Fresco was rightly decided. Fresco gave us a list of things that the trial court can look at and suggestions as to how they can use these different factors if they think it's appropriate in their particular case. But the court was very clear that it was not going to give a particular case, which I think is what Justice Martinez and Justice Bender talked about in their concurrence, was that there was a little bit of a disagreement as to whether or not we can give a rule of criminal procedure. This court can just come down and say, this is what you need to do when these videotapes are in place, or we can leave it up to the trial court and give them a list of factors to consider and suggestions as to how they can go about doing these, introducing these tests and giving them back, the videotapes and putting them back in the jury room. And like I said, it's a unique case here because you gave these suggestions after this court had made its decision, but I think Fresco gives the trial courts the guidance they need. I think in this particular case, the question is, what was done in this particular case? Was it an abuse of discretion, and did it amount to an unfair prejudice to the defendant? And our argument is it did not. And if the court doesn't have any other questions for me, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. A few points. The first point is actually the sequence of events, if you look at volume 9 of the record, is closing arguments were held before the court made the decision to give the videotape to the jurors. That's kind of the last thing that happened before the court recessed for that day, and then the jury came back and deliberated. So the sequence of events is actually the reverse of what was discussed in the previous argument. Also, this isn't an issue about the jury giving weight to this. They're entitled to give weight to this evidence. They're entitled to believe this evidence. It's about giving undue emphasis or placing this evidence on a pedestal compared to the other trial testimony. And that's why the distinction with testimonial evidence and non-testimonial evidence is critical. That's why decisions in other jurisdictions have held that this is the type of evidence that should not go back to the jury. And Justice Martinez, following up on one thing you suggested, the New Jersey Supreme Court adopted a New Jersey appellate decision which had said that in this type of situation, one thing the trial court must do is allow the playback in open court, but then also add any necessary direct or cross-examination testimony to provide the proper context. So ideally, if the jury wants to review the videotape, they should also review the trial testimony. Obviously, that presents practical difficulties, but that certainly would be the more fair approach. But in this case, what we had was a situation where the jury was allowed to place undue emphasis on the videotape to the exclusion of the trial testimony. And I disagree respectfully with opposing counsel that this tape benefited both parties. Defense counsel objected throughout. I think if you view the videotape, and I've reviewed it several times, it is the prosecution linchpin of the case. And it was therefore error for it to be placed on a higher pedestal than other testimony in the case. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank both counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted, and the court will be